All over the world, the forces of democracy, tolerance, openness, and liberty are in retreat, and autocracy on the rise. Perhaps nowhere signifies that more than today's China, where President Xi has just been awarded a third and unconditional extension of his presidency, something the architect of contemporary China, Deng Xiaoping, tried constitutionally to avoid. There should be no more Mao Zedongs, thought Deng. Instead, we have one again. My guest today is a man who knows the forces at work in China firsthand. He spent 81 days in jail and has been witness to many tragedies of a police state. He is the artist and political agitator Ai Weiwei. He is a brilliant artist. His challenging giant sculptures and artworks depicting the struggle for liberty and personal autonomy have enthralled millions. But he's more than that. Politics and art are indissolubly linked, he says. He is a political thinker, a social commentator, an author, an architect, a filmmaker, and son of Chinese poet Ai Qing, whose exile during the Cultural Revolution, forced to clean toilets, foreshadowed his own exile. He now lives not in China, but partly in Portugal and partly in Cambridge, where we are meeting today. Thank you so much for coming on the We Society podcast. When we contacted you and said this podcast series is called The We Society, what was your first thought when you heard a podcast called The We Society?
Well, it shows two aspects. First, I would say whoever you are referring to, what is a we?
Exactly, yeah.
And it's very hard to define that, and but why we, and rather than I. So then I read what you have been discussed about this extreme individualism after the Enlightenment, and yes, it shows many philosophical thinking and background about as individual or collected individual will. So that's how I think about it.
And you, in a way, have kind of, I mean, your biography, your life is a story about, in a way, the excesses of we, I mean, collectivism, Chinese style, kind of, I mean, totalitarian, authoritarian, despotic, you can use what adjective you like, but it's pretty, it doesn't correspond to any conception of respect for individual liberty. So when you ask who is the we, I mean, in your own mind, do you reconcile the we with personal liberty, with personal liberty?
In my mind, you know, when I grew up, there's no such thing as I. The I is always would be criticized and self-criticized, but we always talk about the we. Still today, you know, China, the new government mentioned people in this speech about 150 times. So the people is equal to the words we. So they are reinterpreted their position which they represent as we. But when I went to United States in 1981, I hate to see anything related to we. We want to say I want to do this and want to do that. So the individualism is always attractive to any people want to break away from the way.
I understand that. I understand that perfectly. I mean, what we try to do in the We Society and what we try to do as social scientists is we try to think through how you kind of reconcile the necessity of there being a we with the necessity of respecting individual autonomy, and getting that blend right between the I and the we is the secret to the good society Maybe, I don't know. Maybe your view is perhaps different. Well, having, I mean, your experience is so different from mine and so many people listening to you. I mean,
it's
you,
true. It's, you know, even you talk about not just my experience, you talk about why China is like China today. So they still think we in China are very different. They reflect very different values. You know, it's about a whole set of common sense or values are completely different. So that's why they still think the West is a potential enemy, because that way is different from our way.
But in a sense, you kind of live a greater truth, which is that, you know, human beings, wherever they are, need liberty. When I was working on my book in China, I wrote a book 10 years ago called The Writing on the Wall. I was introduced to a number of Chinese intellectuals and Chinese officials, you know, who said, you know, don't give up on your campaign to argue for democratic institutions in China. We want them too. And they would say this privately. I remember once I was walking to an official's car, and he took me by my hand and held me back and said, we only had 30 seconds to speak without someone hearing him. And he said, I don't think that the language you hear from the party is the language that we believe in. We want democratic institutions. We want the rule of law, not the rule by law, but the rule of law. We want checks and balances. We want freedom of the press. You know, these are universal kind of desires. I was very, very struck by this. Lived on with me all my life. And now I'm sitting in front of you in this room in Cambridge. What are you thinking when I say this?
Well, there's, of course, there's certain truth in there. You know, we all, for me, I always think it's better to have a democracy or to have individual freedom of speech or freedom of expression. This is a very essential meaning for life, because that reflects why an individual is an individual. But at the same time, we also would questioning its liberty or democracy a fixed concept, like very general in the West. When you talk about liberty, that means you have liberty, the others doesn't have it, or you have a democracy and the other doesn't have it, which not all true. And there's also very strong culture characters in there, you know, with history, with our how we become a society like today, either in the West or in China. So those factors has to be clearly dealt with or think of. So because it doesn't really come as a surprise. It has been a long history. And that history, through human struggle, come out very different conclusion. And so-called intelligence, because you have to assume everybody's equipped with their own rationality and argument. So that makes the world much complex. That's how I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So we cannot simplify who has a freedom or democracy, but rather to deal with how they would function under their argument.
I mean, here you are living in the West now, and there are fears that if Donald Trump runs again in 2024, he may be the last freely elected American president. And you watch in Western Europe, you know, the right, the nationalist right, who are indifferent really to democratic freedoms and checks and balances, on the rise. Do you think we in the West are kind of colluding in the decline of our liberties?
I think certainly there are hidden problems there. You know, society almost like the weather. You have a spring, you have a summer, you of course after summer is autumn, you know, and the winter follows. So we can never really just stretch it. You can stretch it for a few days, but still you have to accept this is some kind of circle there. So I think the West enjoyed the great moment after the, let's say, Enlightenment or later the New World Order or globalization, which is extension of the
Western values.
Yeah, values, but be more clear, capitalism.
Yeah.
So, but the capitalism have a potential problems because it's about free enterprise and competition. And when China are equipped it with this to become as a unit, as a way, one special way, they competed it with the Western democratic society, and they presented a much more efficient, decisive, and powerful, because they are unified as one person. The whole China, 1.4 billion people as one. And here you have a much divided yep. interests and the different companies, different interests. So the competition less efficient appeared to be. So that's why China become a problem.
What should Western governments do about China?
Well, the Western government, if that represent the ideology of the cooperative or the one, the real players, then there's not much choice, because as the German have just mentioned, or actually a United States businessman just mentioned, they built this system with China in past 30 years, which is as precise as a Swiss watch. So it's very difficult to think to cut it off. And that's what the Chinese diplomat says, how do you cut it off? I mean, you and you're in me. So I think those are truthful. So we have to look at the world as purely competitive in terms of economics and the political situation. And so if you cannot really clearly define yourself, and you also cannot define the China, so you don't know even whom you're fighting with. So that is a real question.
Do you think China will try to retake Taiwan?
Oh, that's a very clear and a simple answer. Yes, China will do it for sure. And China prepared everything in past 70, 80 years to make that happen. That is inevitable.
How should the West react to that? Should we try and...
I don't think the West will react to that. West already betrayed Taiwan when they kicked Taiwan out of the United Nations. You know, Taiwan was representative of China. Then when Nixon and Kissinger went to China, completely they just kicked Taiwan out, and they accept China as a solid communist, as a friend, 1971-72. We have to remember the history.
Yeah, and the Chinese play it long. They laid the foundations for what may happen.
So that means the West think Taiwan is not even relevant compared to what they get from China.
That's a profound thing you've said.
I mean, you asked a very hard truth, but that is clear. And China is very clear about that too.
They are very clear. I mean, she's been very clear about that. You could argue that one of the reasons why he wanted to extend his term was because he wanted to achieve the takeover of Taiwan before stepping aside. He's very clear about that. I mean, he said that.
Yeah, I think he's the one trying to also think he's capable in achieving that.
Oh. So that is a profound warning. The Americans will have to decide whether they're going to retaliate and try and protect Taiwan's autonomy.
I really a little bit cynical about that. I don't know. I wonder how many people have been in Taiwan or even know, you know, the geographic location about Taiwan. So maybe I'm too cynical, but Taiwan is not Florida, or Ireland.
No, it's not.
Taiwan is a far island next to China.
Where does it go next? I mean, your artworks, your documentaries, your writing is inviting us to really take our liberty profoundly seriously. I mean, you've been very fiercely critical of what happened in Hong Kong. You've been very critical about the kind of terrible cover-ups of the deaths of the 5,000 in Shikwan. Where does it go next? Where do you go next?
Well, for me, it's ever since the one thing, you were born and you only going to stay a period of time, and you have to always give yourself a clear identity, what you care about and what you are trying to defend or announce yourself. So all those activities, no matter about social injustice or refugee situation, and they are as one. It's either you protect the humanity or you're hurting it, or you let someone do something which you not agree with, but do you care about it? So if you care about it, you have to react on it. So as artists, I use my way to react. And maybe all those things are not going to make any kind of impact or not even worth it, but it's perfectly worth it when I can have my peace of mind to say I did it, you know, so I will not be regret.
Yep. You should know that when I knew I was interviewing you 24 hours ago and just telling people, a few people that I was interviewing you, they had all of them, one way or another, seen your art. Sometimes in London, sometimes in Japan, and you know, it had made a big impact on them. So you know, it's, you have made an impact. You've made an impact.
Thanks for the today's society. The communications can be much easier than before. But a writer in the past, they also make a very strong impact without internet today. And their vision and their state of mind can last for a long time. So I always ask why. I think they are really made an effort in protect the humanity, the basic identity of a human or human society, trying to insist on social justice.
Where does your bravery come from?
I'm not a sophisticated person. If I measure many things I did, I may come out different result. I'm too simple. I don't think I'm in danger. I think I've been given the opportunity or privilege to have that possible voice. And And that not always belongs to me. And, you know, years later, none of us are going to be here. But I don't want to be shamed with my children. He would say, oh, my father never really cared about it. So, yeah.
Your father's experience has had a big impact on you. I mean, living in a dug, because you lived kind of virtually underground when you were living in during the Cultural Revolution for years. I mean,
yes, I spent about 5 years in a dugout, you know, underground with no electricity, no water, and it's so primitive, you know, kind of living. Cannot imagine. And if they put me there, I don't think I can survive today. But I admire my father as a very well-known poet, studying in Paris, going through the revolution, and has still be alive and clean the public toilets under all kind of insult and mistreatment, still survived. And without him, you know, he has this kind of big heart.
I mean, I think people should really understand what that means. I mean, your father was living in a dugout, not much light, and every day he has to clean the public toilets in the town where you were living. And if he didn't, if he was ill one day, then there was more feces and everything else to clean up the following day. And he did that for, I mean, more than 10 years? It was 15
years? 5 years.
Yeah.
But he was in the same location for almost 20 years, forbidden to write. But that 5 years was extremely difficult.
And you witnessed this firsthand, of course. You lived with him.
Well, that's my first memory, to see my father, how difficult for him to clean those so-called toilet. It's nothing to do with modern toilet. It's a really primitive type of location. So he did in the very harsh winter, could be 40 degrees below zero, and a very hot summer also can be 30, 40 degrees above zero. And he's a writer. You know, he never had a physical work, but he survived.
Mm. And then you had your own jail sentence.
My compared to him is nothing. It's like a little vacation. I was secretly detained and for 81 days. I don't even know the location. And then even the soldier detained me don't know the location where they are. And they all secretly put in this kind of location. So,
just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organization behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from the cost of living crisis to the war in Ukraine, in every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff, or Belfast, you'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. I find it hard to understand myself, but I mean, you must have wrestled with this, both your father and you must have wrestled with this, trying to get to the bottom of why the people who initiated this, the people who initiated the things that your father had to do, initiated your own captivity. I mean, what was going on in their heads? I mean, why do they, what are they frightened of? I mean, what's driving them? I mean, do you yourself understand it?
I can't understand it. Because I always have to think on their, in their shoe to say why they have to do that. When I was arrested, I was thinking if they don't arrest me, they let me to keep expression myself with my way, the world will change. And they will completely lost their legitimacy of control. And easily people would be on my side. So the economy that can challenge, and that'll be the nightmare for many people.
Yeah, and I get that. But I mean, we're all human, and we're all asking ourselves the question, you know, why are we here? And Aristotle, kind of, you know, what makes people happy, ultimately, is to use the fruits of your brain and your capacities with your hands to make the world in some way a bit better. And I mean, people kind of asking your father to clean the toilets for 5 years or keeping you in captivity for 81 days, they can't tell themselves a story about how they're making the world better. I mean, they know that they're inflicting cruelty.
Which is true. And but their perspective, their world point of view, is very much based on another set of philosophy. You know, China has been an empire or a kingdom for 2,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And they never had a real strong challenge of that. So even now, they are in very strong hands or very strong performance of economics. I would say in the past 30 years, they catch up very fast. And they still think this kind of authoritarian state is the only possibility for them to hold up. And they gave all the glories to this party, Communist Party, which is a very big party. It's about 100 million
members. Yeah,
members.
And growing.
100 million members. Can you think about that? And they strongly, formally controls the power. So, if you just think of a nation as a vehicle, if you have an engine like that, it runs, they think perfectly well, and you think you can stop and change to another model, I don't think that is much more less likely in next 2 decades. So they were running tough. And if you look at how they're dealing with this zero pandemic control, that already equipped them the new technology and the new way as an excuse to protect the people, to equip them to a more scientific or more...
As they would say, scientific.
It's amazing efficiency.
The social credit system is extraordinary, isn't it? Where they, you know, the degree of surveillance in China, and if you kind of jaywalk across the road inadmissibly in some crossing, you'll get a text kind of within hours telling you what you've done. I mean, they really know what that degree of micro control.
They know so well. They know we are talking together. If we're in China, then before you walk out this hotel room, someone was standing outside the door or knock on the door to say, hey, come, we need a talk. So it's equipped them so well. If you see something on internet, then your health card can turn to another color. Then you're locked in the room, can never be out. Someone, they never had any kind of COVID, but they've been locked out because they may post one line on social media. So
COVID, in your view, has been
used very well.
To really ratchet up social control in China.
Yeah, it's like a big practice about how to formally control the mass. And no human society ever come to this degree, the government can easily control to every corner in the society. It can be most remote corner, could be Xinjiang or Tibet or wherever, to know exactly the pattern of behaving of any individual.
But there is restiveness about this. I mean, there's two ways of looking at this. There's the pessimistic way of looking at it, which is, it's incredible. It's Big Brother 4.0. It's an inhibition of every human instinct. There's that way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that they have to do it because they know they're not legitimate, and that actually it's a sign of weakness in a curious way they have to do it, even though they're very strong. And that you get people in apartment blocks who've been kept in an apartment block for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, because there's been COVID there. And, you know, this stops being political. This is about, I want to go to the store and buy what I need to buy, but I can't do it. I'm being forbidden to do that. And that degree of micro-control becomes kind of non-legitimate. So there's two things going on here, is there not? But you would say, Will Hutton, get real. The thing that's going on is oppression.
Well, if it's from a Western point of view, of course, there's a lot of conflicts or struggle of what we believe. But in China, people believe power, believe the one who are in the power are doing the best for the nation. So most people, 99% of people, would think that still it's a rational or reasonable policy.
So your view is the overwhelming majority of...
Overwhelming.
Overwhelming majority of people go along with this.
Of course, they have an argument, what can we do if we don't go over with it, you know, because the controlling power are so restricted. And also, immediately you are show, you know, the already bad situation to be much worse condition. So you'll be locked up, or your door will be walled, and the people are dying, someone, or jump out of the window, but still, that's just a few.
It's a very, the picture you paint is a very stark one, very stark one.
But that's the reality. And that is the reality. And then you have 1.4 billion people act that way. That is a bit scary.
Very scary. It's very scary. I mean, you're simultaneously a man who champions individual liberty, but is fiercely critical of social injustice. Yet to deal with social injustice, you know, there has to be some authority that will, you know, tax, will create a welfare system, will give people justice through the court system. I mean, you do need public structures to deal with injustice. And yet your experience of the public sphere in China is terrifying.
It is true. This is almost like a paradox. You know, how much you want the order, and who is giving the order, and that in the history it can be religion, or it can be ideology, or it can be modern education. And some kind of establishment of value has to exist. But of course, eventually it has to benefit the individual. We have to measure any government to see if that benefits a development of an individual.
There's some social scientists who argue precisely that, who say, there's a Professor Richard Layard, who's the author of the World Happiness Movement, and he says every public policy has to be judged by whether it makes individuals more happy. Well, when you hear that, what do you think?
I would say more happy maybe replace more healthy. Healthy is a word not just about happiness, but about our mind condition, which can make individual functioning and make society functioning. So that is a challenge. It's not necessarily, the happiness.
So you have a holistic view of health. Health is everything. Professor Layard is the author of he thinks that mental ill health is one of the great problems of our time, and so he champions measures to sort out ill health. But you're going much further. You're saying the totality.
I think the totality of health means your relations to environment also, right. to neighbors or to the one who lacking of the resource. So that only means as a human we have a compassion and we have some kind of self-consciousness about our precious time in this planet are given by some kind of magical power, and that can be disappear.
It is magical to be alive. It is magical to enjoy the world. I read somewhere that what makes people happy is to live somewhere aesthetically beautiful and to have kind of access to great space, mountains, lakes, and that you actually, the individual can relate to kind of man-made great things, but also the great things of nature. And that's, and that experience is magic.
And that shows respect. You can be poor, you can be lacking of many things, even knowledge, or doesn't have enough information, but that needs to be respected. So today, the education has a clear problem to say we all have to be equipped by this kind of absolute knowledge or rationality, but that shows very little respect about people who doesn't need that knowledge, still can live with integrity or to have a more self-satisfaction. And that, is that most important? Or just to think you're so superiorly understand everything, but he doesn't even know how to wash a dish?
Yeah. What I'm thinking about, as you've been talking about this, the totality of health, this is in a sense where your art comes in, because your art is, it's very accessible. And people get your art. People get your art and it makes an impact on them. And whatever they're, in a sense, kind of however well or badly educated they are, they get it. Is that part of your mission, or am I misinterpreting you?
I'm a very simple person. I think I have to trust my judgment, because that judgment doesn't really belong to me. It's all given by my experience or my little knowledge and my associations. So by respect that and trust that, maybe I share that with people would also touched by similar experience. And that experience cannot be defined by science or rational mind. That's why art still exists, because we cannot really clearly know why we have a fear.
Is there a piece of art or a documentary you've made or an artwork that when you look back on your career, you think, that was really a bullseye. I'm proudest of that.
I really have nothing to be proud of. It's like someone climb a mountain. Yes, there's much journey ahead of you. Yes, you are still lucky. You are safe. You're not falling down the slope, but still there's much journey ahead of you.
You take it step by step. I'm away. Thank you so much for an extraordinary exchange. You have given you a window into your life with your father and how that impacted on you. you've given us an insight into your art, but above all, you've insisted on our humanity. And democracy may be imperfect, but it's a better way of permitting people to express their humanity. And given your experience and given what you know about contemporary China and your awesome warning that there will be war because China will attempt to take over Taiwan, you are telling us in the West to live our values, really. I think you're telling us to live our values.
It's true. We have to be persistent as a human or as a society. If we cannot live up our values, we become hypocrites. Then we look down at ourselves, you know. So, yeah, it's not easy to do what you say, so...
We're going to try. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to. Now to a podcast we'd love to recommend, Media Storm, hosted by journalists Matilda Mallinson and Helena Wodier, and brought to you from the house of The Guilty Feminist. You follow the hosts as they investigate unreported issues and hear directly from the voices that are missing from the mainstream media. Refugees, sex workers, people who've been in prison, all telling their stories in their own voices. By handing the mic over to minority groups and listening to their lived experience, we're all able to learn so much more about stories we thought we understood. Is the UK really flooded with migrants? Does the war on drugs even work? Where are we actually getting our oil? Listen to Media Storm now to hear from the most important, yet most silenced people at the centre of the story, wherever you get your podcasts.